And I know nobody talks about being afraid of their style sheets, but everybody is. So let's talk about it.
The Shopomaniacs, you're listening to another episode of the Shop Talk Show. Chris, how are you?
I'm good. Yeah, kind of a crazy week this week. I flew in last night. I was just for a couple days. I was in Vail, Colorado, which was interesting. Nice. It was off season, so it's this weird little, it's a ski town, you know, just abandoned because it's, I don't know, it just must be the weirdest off season week for them, but great for little conferences. So this was like my stepsister, like helps run these brick and mortar music stores. And they like are part of this group that's existed forever that they just get together and like hang out and learn from each other and have their own like mini conference of other people that own brick and mortar music stores. There's a guy there I met from Austin, Texas, runs a music store there, and just they get together because they're like kindred spirits in a way, just like tech conferences happen. They get together, and but they take it real seriously in that they hang out, and that, you know, there's like an ease of how they hang out. You know, when you meet somebody who's also a tech, you can kind of just sit there and have a beer or whatever, and it feels very like camaraderie, even though I don't know, you might even be like minorly competitors, but you just never even think about it like that. You know, you're like, you do something totally different in tech. And we have lots to talk about, but, and we do. So, but it was so weird to see that in another genre of business entirely.
Sounds like Carl Smith's thing, that Bureau of Design.
It
design
totally bureau. Does. Yeah. But that's kind of more close to home in a way, and that they're, these are agencies that we kind of, I get why they do that. And then to see it again happening. And from this was cool. And they hired Miranda, you know, to my wife to come in and like, you know, teach them all the massive amount of stuff she knows about the digital world and social media and all that. So I was just there being dad while she was helping them out, which is so cool. And they like, they do everything. They like critique each other's businesses. They open their books and look at what's working and what's not. And they,
that's called collusion. It's a federal crime.
I wonder, you know, but no, these are the small dogs fighting the big dogs, you know.
I think that's cool. I like that attitude of share what you know, which is kind of a web philosophy, worldwide web philosophy, just can exist in other areas. But then even areas like, you know, what's more analog than like a musical instrument shop? You know what I mean? Like,
right.
Like acoustic guitar shop, you know, but that they need help, you know, going into the digital age, because otherwise people are just buying guitars on Amazon or Guitar Center, which is cool, but just a mega corp.
Yeah. Yeah. They got to talk about how they can change. And there's certainly some of, you know, I heard stories of little shops that are, you know, are too heavy in one area, like sheet music, and that's dying, and they're not evolving, and they're having problems because they're slow to evolve. But get this. Remember that scam we had the other week about the, you get the email about the, you know, the
$8,000, 8-page site. You should be.
Really simple. Oh, my designer.
By the way, needs can you pay my. Yeah. Can you pay my designer? I'll pay you with this stolen credit card, but you pay this designer.
But you kind of understand why people fall for it, because you get the money. It's sitting there in your account. You're like, well, that worked. Mm-hmm. Cool. I guess this seemed sketchy, but it seemed to work. You pay the designer, then you get the charge back because it was a fraudulent charge, probably. This same thing happens in the music thing. I was talking to somebody and they had to, you know, they have to communicate to all their employees. Like if somebody calls up and says, hey, can I buy this? In this case, it was a very expensive accordion, literally a $6,000 accordion. Hey, can I pay for it right now on the phone? I'm going to send my buddy to pick it up. They read off a credit card. The charge goes through. The buddy shows up, gets the accordion. They take off. The credit card was fraudulent. Then they get the charge back. Apparently, this is like 101 fraud crap for them. They deal with this stuff all the time, and it's common knowledge to not, but it's common knowledge to the owners of these businesses, not necessarily to a high schooler that you hire to work for you.
Yeah.
Nothing against that. High schoolers are dumb. They just don't know. They got to be told, hey, if somebody calls and wants to charge something, it seems reasonable, but it's a fraud. So just don't engage with that. But it was essentially the same fraud, which I find fascinating.
They're paying with not a card, they're paying with a spreadsheet, right? They're just reciting what they have on.
I think so. That's you don't get the plastic. I don't know that just the fact that it's a phone call at all, like, adds something to the sketchiness of it. Cause if it doesn't go through, then they'd be like, oh shoot, no, that was my, I had grabbed the wrong card there. Let me try this other one.
the
spreadsheet thing. I don't know that to be true. I don't know all the details there, but yeah, I think just the phone call is the problem.
Sorry, I wrong card. This one's going to have a totally different zip code.
Yeah.
I got this back when I was in Google Sounds, keyboard sound.
Yeah.
Canada.
Yeah. let me use my random country generator.
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah. Thanks. And, you know, there's still feedback trickling in from 307 where we asked for feedback. And yeah, we read every one of those. So thanks to telling us when you started listening and all that. Lots of groups, some people from the beginning, middle, and different skill levels, different all kinds of stuff. Been fascinating. We heard from one fella whose wife was in the hospital for kind of a long period of time. And so his work told him that he could work third shift, you know, because he's got to deal with hospital stuff during the day, and he was continuing to work then at night the best as he could. But his boss was concerned that he wouldn't have, you know, there would be no water cooler stuff. He wouldn't have coworkers, essentially. He's working these odd hours. And that's when he discovered podcasts, and he thinks that a podcast like this one as his coworkers, which, nice to have you as a coworker, Mr. George.
Nice.
And his boss was like, yeah, that's great. You know, he wasn't concerned about communication because apparently that was fine. But just the idea that you're not leveling up as much when you're totally alone, well, podcasts can be your coworkers.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. It's almost like a mentoring or something like that. I definitely use it like that. I actually, before we hopped on this call, and I stayed up late working last night. I got a deadline. It's not the most ideal thing, but I stayed up working, and I like powered through all the Google I/O stuff. I just kind of, like, there's, you know, a dozen talks, and I'm still working through it, like this morning, because I just like to have, you know, I like to have Googlers tell me how to do my job. No, I like to have just a perspective, especially from Google, who is very close to the browser metal, I guess you'd say. I like to have their perspective in how I should approach a website. I think that helps me. They also like drop mad business statistics, like if your site takes over 5 seconds, you lose 76% of your business, stuff like that. So, I mean, this is all stuff I want to just drop in a meeting or in a PowerPoint. So, I just wish there was, I wish there could be a little more interaction. I guess I do talk to Googlers on Twitter and stuff like that occasionally, but, you know, like I think there's a very close line between like a Twitch streamer and then like a chat room or something, you know, like for like actual mentoring, you know, like you pay to upgrade to the, like, ask any question you want at any time level or something. I think that'd be an interesting, I'd love to see who's kind of doing that. And maybe people like West Boss and that, mm-hmm. you know, those kind of online educator people are already kind of doing that, but I'd be curious.
All right, we're going to do some Q&A this week.
Hey, meat and potatoes.
Yeah.
Show.
This is an interesting one about min and max, which is one of those functions that I think a lot of people are familiar with because of CSS Grid, and I think doesn't really exist anywhere outside of CSS Grid, but it's a function which you pass it, you know, two values, and it calculates One of them's the minimum, one of them's the maximum, might be somewhere in between. Kind of cool. Dan Goodspeed writes in, I was just listening to the bit about min and max calculations in Calc in episode 308. I was if I were writing the CSS specs, I'd offer two extra fields to the calc function like this. So font size, calc, 1M plus 1VW, for example, like a viewport sizing typography kind of thing, comma, 12 pixels, comma, 48 pixels. So in a sense, what he's saying is the smallest possible size would be 12 pixels, the largest possible size, 48 pixels, and everything else would be calculated by that first piece of calc. So, and he's right that there, you know, if you want to have viewport size typography, which includes a calculation that includes viewport units or whatever else, it's a little tricky to add both a minimum and maximum to that, because here's what doesn't exist in CSS: min font size, max font size. And he's saying, I'd add this to everything: padding, margin, width, height, whatever. Well, with width and height, we have min height and we have min width. So those exist. And if anything, it would just be sugar to add a min max like function to those, to like the width property. Hey, that'd be cool. I'm down with sugar, you know. But are we going to get min font size and max font size? Dan is saying, I don't care if we get those properties. I'll just put it right in the calc function itself. And I'm like, I don't know. I don't know enough about it.
Hey, I would love to. I think, is it not part of like CSS 4, like level 4 selector, like a min function? Min function, CSS. I this came up today. Somebody was talking about fit text, and that's like exactly how fit text works. You need like a min and a max.
You pass it like an array of values, and it picks the smallest.
You actually just pass it like the parent's width, and then it kind of like says like it defaults to like 1/10 of the width of the parent, you know. But you can kind of modify that with a denominator, like how aggressively it'll size, and but then it has a min and a max, and that prevents text from becoming unlegible, like lower than 8 pixels or too big over like 1,000 pixels. So I would love it. And I would actually, you know, it would be great if I could use that CSS variable trick where you just on resize, you just keep like, you could even do it very lazily, just like, you know, request idle callback. Okay, get the width of the thing and then like set a CSS variable and then it'll resize, you know, the function or the CSS is just looking for a resize, kind of like some of that experiments like Dan Wilson has been doing with CSS variables. And I would love to have that. And then like, I just have this function with a min and a max value sitting in my CSS that just respond to that. But it just, I don't know. It doesn't look like it's there. It's not easily Googleable. It looks like it was maybe part of CSS 3 at some point, like calc.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it's, I can't find it anymore, and that's a bummer. But you know,
it's tricky to think
min-max about. Max.
It's, I don't think that we're going to see the calc function be updated to take mins and maxes. It just seems unlikely for some reason. Although who knows? But a minimum function I could see being useful alone, as well as a maximum function, as well as min max being extended to work in other properties and do interesting things. But these things are not just like, duh, just do this. That is, we are not duh, just do this territory here. This stuff is nuanced and tricky and there's history and legacy stuff and whatever. Like, it's just, I don't know what to tell you other than it's complicated, you know?
Well, and in the second we solve all the complexity on how to code it, well, now you got to get like 5 mega corporations to agree to build it. Simultaneously.
Yeah, right. It's got to be spec'd out really well. It's got to have use. There's always 3 players. There's always the specs and the browsers, like we just talked about. And there's the use case people. There's the developers. There's somebody that needs to like demonstrate the usefulness of it.
We should start a campaign to get one of us on TPAC, Chris, where it's either,
I don't know what that is.
That's the where they go to Japan and they drink a bunch and then they talk about what should be in CSS. One of us should be in that. We should start a campaign, maybe both of us, and where we go on the road and do a show in Tokyo and we are representatives of the authoring community, because that doesn't exist. It's just a bunch of browser people.
They invite trying there's to, invited experts. Yeah,
seize the means like of CSS production. What?
There's invited experts to stuff like that, isn't there?
Often? We could be invited experts.
There's probably a reason we're not invited experts.
Well, yeah,
I don't know. I
probably burned all them damn bridges a long time
ago. I like thinking about this particular one, though, because it seems like, so a min-max function takes two arguments. One of them is the minimum, one of them is the maximum. What it is missing in a way is that, like, well, what about that in-between? And that in-between is kind of handled in grid already, because you're kind of setting, like, what should I, like, it's kind of implied in the grid context, or it's not applied outside of the grid context. Like, width with a min-max function would just be sugar for setting min-width and max-width, which is fine, but it's not that interesting. What's more interesting is width, like, min, middle, max, or something. Like, here's the minimum. Yeah. Here's what I want you to calculate in the middle, and here's the maximum. Because that's less implied when you're just setting the width values.
Yeah, min max is just like, never go below this and never go above this. You got
Well, which one am I going to do then? Like, which one should I set in a situation where that's ambiguous?
Yeah. Yeah. But well, so what I had to do on FitText was just kind of this thing is like, I do I think it's a max function, and then I do a min function inside of the max function. So it's like a double function.
Yeah.
You know, like a double calc. So it's not ideal, but again, I would just love to like pass a variable, and then I do most of it in CSS with calc, and all my JavaScript has to do is just report a parent width to a thing, and then it can do whatever the heck it wants. That would be cool.
Well, I've been following Mr. our old friend Brad Frost lately. Has been the target of some interesting internet conversations.
That poor boy punched the bee's nest.
Yeah.
Of CSS in JS.
Well, that's been a bee's nest forever, because it feels like there's two sides, even though there shouldn't be. That seems ridiculous. But anyway, bro, I don't know where he dug up the screenshot, but I'll tell you where. You, go ahead. You know where? I have no idea where. But it's a pretty gnarly looking JSX screenshot of how to handle styling in a component in React, and it really does look like garbage to me. I'm like, what the flip?
It's like BR city. There's 10 BRs. There's a bunch of ternaries like to do styling.
Yeah, margin right 3. You're like, oh, that's nice. There's like, yeah.
Yes.
Options.header font family dot join with a comma in there, because it must be like an array of font. It just seems like a freaking mess to me. That this is, but what, and then the argument was, you know, this is Brad just poking the bee's nest. Of course, everybody, you know, a lot of people are like, this is a mess. You found a mess, but this isn't symptomatic of all CSS and JS. There's definitely clean ways to approach this.
So people say that, but I think that's like, no true Scotsman would ever write this bad. This came from Gatsby. The like very popular React CMS.
Yeah,
like,
okay.
This came from Gatsby and their like colors, like function or whatever, like however they promote a style guide or something like that.
Well, that sucks.
Like,
it's too big of a project. So
this is made by people who are very good at React, like promoting React and selling React very hard. So I want to take out that whole argument that like, yeah, well, somebody did bad and you're just finding the low hanging fruit. He's like, no, he found a very popular project with a very gnarly piece of code. And then, but then some people are like, it looks fine to me, you know? And it's like, whoa, okay. All right, cool.
Anyway, and he kind of followed this up with a post that was like, well, here's my problem in CSS.js, regardless of this screenshot. And he laid out some stuff. One of them was resonated with me pretty strongly, which was this like reusability of their framework. Like, let's say you have a React code base. That's great. Maybe I'll pick CSS modules or Glamorous or whatever to go with it. I don't think that's a big deal. But then now you have a WordPress property too. Well, what the hell do you do then? You've mm-hmm. now you've made this nice componentized pattern library thing that's totally useless in your WordPress. And how rare is that? Not really. I have CodePen, which is a somewhat complicated app, but it's not definitely not the world's most complicated world. We have CSS files that we can kind of share between the React code base and just the Rails code base and the WordPress site over here, and it all just kind of lives together and it's okay.
I would even go to say I think it's foolish if your company's static content is rolled into your dynamic application. I mean, that's just like extra overhead in that project.
Sure, we've all seen that. A pile of static components.
Yeah, your corporation needs like 400 static pages, privacy policies, terms of use, blah, blah, blah. You know, like all the hiring, careers, you know, all this stuff. Like you need, like it needs all that like stuff in there. You'd probably be better like spinning up a Jekyll or a WordPress and just spitting things out statically and then sharing some kind of CSS file to where everyone, but you know, in CSS and JS, when that's, you know, the current trend is like a computer makes up class names for you. That's not going to work for your WordPress.
For your static site, it's not. Remember 12 episodes ago, this was my big prediction for the future of this stuff, is that when you make styling choices, you're going to hit this fork in the road. Is this styling meant to be global for everyone to share, or is this style scoped to this component specifically? And that's what we haven't seen yet, is this easy divide. Because I would say, okay, your site has static content. Well, it's largely going to use contain like big layout stuff that is shared between everybody. It's going to have all this base set of typography going to use. That's enough to do your terms of service page. But it's okay that there's some like component specific styles over here, but it's not covered in it. It's not setting my font stack. It doesn't have isolated styles for my buttons, but it has a little bit of stuff that's unique to it in it. And that's where is that happy medium? I never see it.
Are you proposing some kind of single file HTML import based web component system where my blog and my app could just pick from a CDN full of static components? Oh, Chris, you're describing the dream that was crushed by Firefox so many years ago in 2014, 2015.
And this conversation just gets wider and wider from here, because then Brad continued to find this is what, like he's
well yeah oh go ahead
no sorry. No let's I'm not widen it yet let's see what
well no so well I think like yeah this conversation just gets broader and like you know very almost I would say like religious point of views start kicking in and it's like oh Brad just doesn't get it and it's like oh Brad does component systems a little bit, you know? And then, you know, then the CSS people are like, oh, JavaScript people don't even understand CSS. And it's like, well, no, maybe they understand CSS. They have like the global thing is really a deal breaker for them and they don't like it. And so like, you know, it's really hard to be like, I don't know. There's a lot of characterization of the other party, you know, or straight up. It's like, oh, you don't do JavaScript. You're not a real programmer or it's just kind of really like it starts getting into this tribalism, I think, that is really, really unhelpful. So I'd love to see like it break out of that. Some people followed up with posts that were kind of cool and helpful. Brian Munzemeyer, murdered your last name.
Right. This is a good one. And it kind of comes from this. The question that kicked this off on the Shop Talk show side was Jitendra Vyas writes in, is there any benefit of using CSS and JavaScript over Atomic CSS, which Atomic CSS kind of comes from Bradland to begin with. But yeah, which involves him in a different way. But Atomic CSS is kind of, you can think of, what's the little product they make? The Pattern Lab, right? Which is a way to work with Atomic CSS. And Brian, who you're about to talk about here, works on Pattern Lab as well.
Well, Brian works on the Node version of Pattern Lab. But there's a little distinction, like Atomic CSS, Atomic Design is the like split your things into components. In React, Dan Abramov, creator of React, was even like, React was inspired by this idea of Atomic Design that Brad has kind of pioneered. So Atomic Design is the split it up into components. Atomic CSS is a lot of that like utility class based, you know, PBX5, you know,
yeah,
stuff like that. So,
you're right. This is a bit different because there's different. It's tricky though. Is that There's different types of atomic CSS.
Brian has found, says he's using CSS and JS, and he has a few benefits. Micah Godbolt also wrote a post about he's using it with Fabric UI, which is like how office products, I guess, are kind of building their UI with React. He says he's getting a lot of value out of it too. So it's interesting. I still maybe have some questions, you know.
Yeah.
Anytime somebody's like, oh, CSS and JS is the perfect solution. Okay, why? Scale. And you're like, all right, tell me about it, you know. And then they're like, and theming. And you're like, okay, like I've done theming before. It's a pain, but you know, if your server can spit out a style block,
you're mostly there. Oh, many of us work in theming based apps anyway. That's the only, I shrug at it because I'm like, it comes up once in a while, but it's like,
it seems like cool use case, you know, and then
doesn't represent the industry or whatever. What I like about it is the throwaway styles that if I'm going to put like that, I have a component and I don't need the component anymore, then those styles immediately leave with it. And I think that's cool. I like that. Because, you know, industry-wide problem of the style sheet that grows over a decade and that people are afraid of. And I know nobody talks about being afraid of their style sheets, but everybody is. So let's talk about it, you know? Like, I can't delete
people
this
are
little...
afraid of JavaScript, too, though.
Yeah.
You know?
But you delete the component, of course the JavaScript goes away. Because that's what the component is. But where do the styles... Do the styles live on, or do they die, too? And if the styles die too, that's kind of
cool. And even if you like refactor the hero or something, you don't get, no one deletes hero.hero from the style sheet. They create hero-new, you know, like no one does the work. And that, I think that's like the respect issue too. Like CSS is seen as less than, I think. We've had kind of shows about that with like Manny Michael and I think there's been like, I think like a lot of the care into like deleting classes and trimming and maintaining that CSS file is not done. So, but anyway, sorry, I interrupted. CSS does just kind of grow. I think any file or any feature or any product or application will just grow, but CSS has a tendency to grow.
I just wanted to offer some like, because, I don't know, gray area between these two worlds a little bit. I think the problem is the painting these people into two worlds and saying, these people like CSS and JS and these people don't, and you should either use it or not use it, or good or bad, or all this stuff. And I think there's nuance between it. I'd like to say that I don't ship a lot of products with CSS and JS, but I'm not afraid of it. I don't think it's a bad idea. I don't think you're a bad person for using it. I don't any of those things, but I think there's traps to using it, and I think there's traps to totally forgetting about it too. And
what I will say, I'm probably not in the pro CSS and JS camp, just in general. It just rubs me the wrong way, or like a separation of concerns, or I feel like we're like you kind of golden hammering JavaScript. We're just saying like, let's just go balls out on this, guys, you know, like we're doing everything. I think there's a lot of gains for CSS and stuff too. I'm working on an Angular project, and Angular is actually very divided. Like whenever you spit up a new component, you don't get one file, you get four files.
Yeah, I've seen this. It looks kind of cool.
You get a HTML file, a SAS file, a TypeScript file, which is your JavaScript, you know, binding component. Any kind of behavior behavior, I guess, or how it functions goes in that. And then you have a spec file, also a TypeScript file for testing. So like that come, that's like anytime you generate a component with a CLI. What I'm finding, I'm working on this project, what I'm finding is something called, I'm calling like the princess is in another castle syndrome, because I'm like debugging like a project or like trying to rehab and redesign and realign, fix up a, a product, and it's like, okay, let's go in. All right, here we go. I'm going to fix this, and I'd make a change, and it doesn't change, you know, because like the scope is wrong in the element. And I'm like, okay, so I'm obviously looking at the wrong thing. So I like find the element, and then I go find that element's like folder of things. And then I go into there and I look at the HTML in there. And then I like go to the CSS file. Like some of it's the like everything separated in Angular adding the problem, but some of it is just really like, the CSS I need to change is somewhere in this whole entire project folder, and I'm not sure where it is. So I have this like Mario, like, hey, the thing you're looking for is not here. Sorry, dude.
Yeah.
And then any change you make, sorry, that's wrong
scope. Are you getting better at it? Is it getting used to it?
No, Chris. I keep thinking I will get better and like,
Do you find yourself in dev tools a lot? Like, okay, why is this style losing? Let me just ask the browser why, and then I'll get my answer, and then I'll go find where in the project that style is getting set.
Well, it's weird. It's like I'll set like a H4, you know, margin bottom 1M, and it like globally, and it like works everywhere except in like two little places, and I'm just like, that's weird. Okay, so somebody wrote some rules somewhere. So it's like, okay, let's go find where the rules are, you know, and just because when you don't get like a, with these kind of things, you don't really get like a SAS map or something like that, a source map or anything like that. You just get like, you know, hey, the computer spit out this weird class name and the computer spit out this weird thing. So good luck. Like,
right.
It injected something at some point via Webpack, and cool, guys, let's figure it out. You know, old man yells at cloud, but I've just been like, I think that symptom I'm describing or that feeling is maybe part of this, you know, everything kind of goes down to the component level. There's kind of like it's the antithesis of, like, no globals, you know, it's everything's local. So I think that's, I don't know. I felt like maybe it's a control thing too. Like I felt like I had more control in a SAS file, like, or a CSS structure, like a folder of just CSS. It's like, all right, I'll figure out where everything is. Like I can just grep one folder too, and it works, you know? So anyway, that's me.
So much to talk about here. If anything in our industry has not shaken out yet, it's this.
But I have one project. I was building a little game. It's in CodePen Projects right now, but it's building a little game.
We're using SAS because I have good news to report to you. If you had problems with SAS, ooh, we just fixed a lot of SAS problems with CodePen Projects.
Yeah, but I don't think I was. Or if you know me, I went
school.
CSS good. A long time ago. I went CSS, and I'm coding it out, and it's a game, so it has a lot of state, and I'm just like, I should maybe be writing this in React, because I think I talked about this on the show before, you know, any game has like levels and, you know, scores and points and enemies and game overs, and so I just like, I'm going to have to rewrite this. And so I'm kind of loathing it, but maybe it's a chance to try out some of this stuff. So, and, or I don't do it and I just go on to something else, Chris. Also an option.
This episode of Shop Talk Show is brought to you in part by Full Story. Full Story is a session replay software that makes finding and fixing bugs a cinch. So no need to like have a customer reproduce them or shoot their own video or something kind of sort of awkward like that, even though those can be super useful for finding bugs. This is how it works with Full Story. You install it on your website. It's incredibly easy to install. And it's kind of like a DVR for your website in a way. You're like literally can watch session replay of it. And it's not video. It's like a recording of the DOM. You're literally watching exactly what's happening on your user's site. So let's say a bug happens, you're notified of the bug, you watch it, and then you're literally seeing exactly their environment and what's going on, and you can pop up in the console and see what error was triggered or what the heck happened to them, what they saw as a user of your website. It couldn't possibly be a better situation for like seeing through your customer's eyes, seeing exactly what's wrong so you can fix it. There's a story here from Dan D, the thread up VP of engineering, who said they used Full Story super quickly, found a bug that's been stumping his team for a week. Oh my God, I've been there. I know what it's like, Dan, who said, you know, they hadn't even thought to use Full Story, but they, you know, used a trial of Full Story, got it integrated, figured out exactly what was wrong, fixed it. So pretty cool. So you can get a 30-day free trial of Full Story, no credit card required. Go to fullstory.com/shoptalk. Check it out. Very cool.
Gina Ehrich writes in, my company has two teams that work in different offices. One of those teams has chosen to adopt Angular 2, and the other has chosen React. Now it's time to put two front ends together for a single project, and they've come up with the idea to stitch them together with iframes. Is this the apocalypse, or will everything be okay? Well, we don't have a lot of information here, but on the surface, feels pretty much like the apocalypse.
Yeah, what you've described is the equivalent of like 18 versions of jQuery. So
how the hell did you get to this point? Are you kidding me? Who decided this was okay? This seems like there was no product/project manager uniting these two teams in a useful way. I mean, this is a mess.
Yep. This is going to be a deal. I wish I had a.
Unless your performance budget says at the top, it's okay that this website takes as long to load as two websites.
Yeah. Not to keep dragging the CSS and JS conversation. You know, one of the things people talk about with that is like, oh, portability. I can just use this in another app. I think you said it, Chris. You're like, oh, I can just take, if I delete this thing, it's gone. Or if I move it over to another thing. And it's like, yeah, but what if you like, you're in this, somebody did an Angular thing and somebody did a React thing. Like, what do you do? I don't actually like know the answer. It's like, I have a client who's looking at something like this, and they are thinking about using Nginx, like server-side includes, to solve this problem. So you get the render of the Angular page and you inject it into the React app at some point. Weird. And it comes from
so there's some server-side rendering, so it kind of doesn't matter what framework it is, sort of, kind of, a little bit.
Yeah, basically it's just server-side include sort of thing, you know. And again, I don't know, yeah, if you're only client side, how does that even work? But maybe you stand up like a really thin, like, what's Puppeteer or something, you know, to kind of like a node app that just renders pages and switches it around. I think the idea came from this site called micro-frontends. I like have beef with it. I think it's like taking a like a really extreme approach to trying to fix like not talking to each other. But that's yeah, kind of
some over engineering concerns, perhaps. Iframes. No.
Yeah. I think iframes are going to cause so many problems. And then you'll like have to build this whole post message layer. If like front end one has to talk to front end two, I don't know if that's going to be fun either. Right.
I just don't know what to say here, you know, like, cause we don't have any context. So maybe it's, you know, maybe it's not as bad as it seems, but I'm picturing this patchwork site of iframes and be like, that's not going to work. What
would you, like just say like, hey, Angular site, you need to rewrite, like you might have to look at who has the least amount of components and go for a rewrite, you know, but that might even be hard too, because Angular might be,
well, that's assuming that you've solved this business problem of now there's one person actually making choices and there's one person uniting these teams in spirit and convincing the other team that this is the right move and keeping morale high, and like this technology choice, it to me seems, yeah, fine, let's pick the right technology, but you really have problems that are way beyond technology at this point.
Yeah, it seems like a CTO level thing, because like, how are you going to hire somebody like must have 5 years of React experience, also 5 years of Angular experience.
Yeah. And you talk about how you bounce around between these frameworks, and I think you're unique in the world a little bit in that way, and that not everybody is equally good at Angular and Vue and Ember and React. And, you know, they share some similarities, but a lot of people just do the bulk of their work in one of them and don't feel particularly comfortable in the other one.
Yeah, I bounce around because I haven't found the one I like yet. So there you go. And I host a podcast where all this comes up all the time. So I probably need to look at them. So. Kind of my job. But and I just, as a consultant, we don't control the stack. You know, we parachute into companies and, you know, it's like, what do you have? And they're like, legacy Java. And you're like, great, let's go for it. You know, I'll install Java on my computer. What's Java? So, you know, stuff like that. So you kind of, at some point, you're also like kind of not a victim, but you're just sort of like relegated to what they have to, the current stack of the current app.
Good luck.
All right. Jana. Yeah. Good luck. Hopefully it's not the end of the world. I would love to know the resolution. Please write a blog post. So Jeremy Smith writes in, do you have a relatively inexpensive Windows laptop or desktop, I guess, that you would recommend for somebody, for testing websites? I work on a MacBook Pro and am able to test on Chrome, Safari, Firefox. I use Xcode Tools Simulator for iOS and that works great, but it seems like my only option for currently testing on Windows is on Browser Stack, which works okay, but I think I'd like to have a real machine in front of me to test on. Christy.
I don't know. I mean, you just buy one if you really want that. I don't know. It just seems like I've had this thought in the past, and I bought a little Acer banger for like $100 or $200 or something, thinking like, oh, this is really going to flesh out the office. And then I didn't ever open it because I was like, this is going to be a pain. There'll be some dumb Windows updates to run. I don't have any expertise in running a machine like that. So it feels like it's just going to become this part of my day that I'm going to despise getting it up to going and stuff. I like cross-browser testing. I pop it open. I pick which browser I want. I fire it up. It's not maybe quite as high fidelity and fast, but it's fine for my needs, you know? But if you find yourself, if half your work week is testing on Windows, then maybe you do need a machine. And then why would you buy the cheapest one on the market? You should probably buy one that you're not going to hate half your week using. It just seems like to me like mm-hmm. the dream of buying like $150, you know, like the cheapest Windows machine in the world to test with is going to be more trouble than it's worth.
Yeah. Have you considered sacrificing one of your coworkers to switch to Windows? Because let me tell you, it works. It works wonders. I'm on Windows, and it's actually very handy. You know, it's like you get a bug report like, oh, this is broken in IE11. It's like, I hit the Windows button and I type IE and I have IE11 like popped up and I can go check it out. You know, and I'm using the actual dev tools. I'm not doing it through the VM sort of software, which, you know, it's just, it's very fast. Like, I feel like if you solve your IE11 problem, you more or less solved your IE9, 10 problem, although not always. There are these document modes you can also switch through. Edge is a really great browser that no one tests on. I can say that because on the daily, I'm finding like, you know, a button or a dropdown or whatever doesn't work. It only works in Chrome. So I really recommend doing that. You know, if you're looking for the cheapest thing, like HP has a $300 laptop. So it's blue, I think. And you could do that.
I undershot a little bit, huh? You're not going to find one for $100 probably. What's like,
you might, I mean, like on like whatever Black Friday probably. If you're looking at
Samsung Chromebook, $159.99, you can get it done. Oh, but that's not Windows. That's a Chromebook.
That's Chromebook. Yeah. The Surface line is pretty good. There's that Surface laptop, that is just, you know, so it folds up or whatever. The Surface Pro, which is the, you know, just the tablet that opens up, that starts at $799. Again, that's not super cheap, but you can kind of start kind of, I don't know, you can start decently low. I think the Surface Laptop is starting from $699. So there's probably your choice. So, because that the reason I recommend the Microsoft hardware is because Microsoft is very much on the, like, here's all that Windows can do. And so it'll have touch stuff, like, you know, like a really good touch screen. And if you come from Mac, you think like touching your screen is really gross, but like as a Windows user, I do it all the time. Like there's maybe few things more satisfying than like punching a window closed. Like you just punch it close, you punch that close button and it just disappears. Or you can like literally smash a like button on YouTube. That feels good. So I recommend it. Yep. So,
okay. Good luck with your testing environment, Jeremy. Let us know what you choose, if you go a hardware route or not.
This episode of Shop Talk Show is brought to you in part by LogRocket, which is like for creating the perfect front-end bug report. It's like every error that happens is shown in the context of the user that experienced that error with a full video replay. It's like you reproduce an issue and can see it happen as if it happened in your own browser. And you do look at it in your own browser. So you're like, watch a video replay. It helps you understand what the user did to trigger that bug. So it's like zero mystery involved when a bug happens, and which is kind of not always perfectly evident in an original bug report. So it basically, they instrument the DOM to record the HTML and CSS on the page, recreating the pixel perfect video of like what happened in it. But in addition, they record like console logs, JavaScript errors, the stack trace, all the network requests and responses that happen with a header and the body and all that, browser metadata, all the stuff. So there's everything you need to figure out not only an error happened, what did it look like? Like, can, you know, because sometimes an error gets triggered and that sucks and you should fix that. But like, now you'll know for sure, did it actually impact that user and their user experience of using your site or not? Did it just kind of like happen, some kind of error happened, but it didn't really like stop the user from being what they were able to do? So that's just a big deal. That's just pretty cool. So that's what LogRocket does, the perfect front-end bug report. So it's logrocket.com/shoptalk to check it out, compare it to other tools out there if you'd like to. There's lots to learn about it. Pretty powerful, pretty cool. You can get started for free. Thanks, LogRocket. Stephen Bennett writes in, this long story short, he's kind of becoming a manager type of role at his work, and there's a bunch of, you know, front-end developers kind of under him, or that he's got a guide in a way, that are kind of, he finds, stuck in their ways and, you know, are so used to the bootstrap world and just prefer that. And he's trying to push them a little bit more forward towards like, can we build our grids if we have to build them or think about them with Flexbox instead, you know, like maybe let's try that. And so he's asking, how do you break the 12-column grid mindset? Not only that, but that type of thinking lends itself to like, oh, we're going to have three breakpoints, a small, medium, and large breakpoint. So it's like when, I don't know, when you're first walking through a spec with a developer, the, you know, like for example, he said the first thing that I was asked was, well, how do I do like call-4 with Flexbox? So I tried explaining the whole like embrace the flex, you know, instead of just defining columns for content to fit, you define the content and the browser handles the rest, kind of. So there's a mental shift that has to happen there. Like, how do you teach the mental shift in a way? And that's a good question. I feel like that's like the, if Jen Simmons has one message for the world, it's that. So I'd definitely like be listening to Jen and her new talks and old talks and breaking that kind of mental barrier between that. I feel like if there's, you know, she's got a lot to say to the world, but if there's one big message I've gotten from her, it's that, like breaking that mindset. I don't even know if I've done it for myself entirely yet. I find it's tricky, especially because design tooling is so, you know, you get a mock-up and you're like, I'll
grid that out as I see it. It's hard. It's harder to mock up a really unusually flexible.
Yeah. I would talk to, or yeah, like make them watch Layout Land, Jen Simmons course. I think, okay, I am not a Bootstrap grid hater. I think there's a lot of people out there who are, but like with Bootstrap, you know, just be the nature of the grid, you're pretty limited. You know, it's like 1, 2, 3, or 4 columns, which that's like why that number 12 is pretty useful, is because you can do like call 6 for a 2 column, you know, call, or you can even do call 3, call 9 to like get like a sidebar layout. Like it's pretty helpful. Like it's a pretty tried and true grid structure for building a website. That said, I am the current project I'm working on that is, I'm under a deadline for. they wrote it in Bootstrap, and the developers really wanted to use Bootstrap. And, you know, it was just kind of like, I understand why, because Bootstrap is like this, like it's a tool. Like it just, it's like a having, I don't know. It's like having your dad's like, workbench, access to your dad's workbench, like with all the tools, you know. It's like, I don't need to like build my own belt sander. Like my dad has one, like it's just there. I just like, it's like using your dad's tool chest, or your mom's.
Isn't that weird though? I would find it hard to believe that I'm a front end developer by trade. I love it. I'm passionate about front end development. This is my job, my career, and my life. And I don't want to build outside of Bootstrap. That is my dad's tool bench, and that's what I like and I want, and that's that. I just feel like there's some divide there. If like you're a deep-on front-end developer type, not that that means you should hate Bootstrap, but you should probably desire to build one yourself or something.
But I think that's the thing. I think with I'm going to just drag this CSS and JS out. Like, I think a lot of people like came from a back end language and get assigned to like make the front end, whether that's Java developers writing the Java templates, or, you know, Node developers now getting into the front end and they're just gonna write it in React or whatever. Like I think there's people, a lot of people who are not like just passionate about the front end. They're just making stuff. And so, you know, so like when you have this sort of toolbox already built, like it's very helpful. But I, you know, I'm in the process of undoing all that work, and I'm finding that CSS Grid is so amazing. I would almost skip Flexbox entirely and just go straight to Grid.
Yeah.
Because you're like, here, I wrote this, you know, layout sidebar, and then I just put 2 divs in there as children and it solved it. And it'll, if you put 100 divs in there, it'll just keep laying it out the same way and over and over and over. And I think like,
maybe that will break the mindset, because Steven is asking, how do you break the mindset? Maybe it's not Flexbox that'll help that digging into that grid syntax, there's just something about it that helps that.
Yeah. And you're just like, look guys, we use one class and we got the whole layout. We didn't do like div class row, div class call SM3, call SM4, call SM8. You know, like we didn't do any of that garbage. Like we just, and I say that's garbage, but it's just like, it's very, I don't know. It's just a very terse way to like lay out a page. So I just said, this is layout, the layout section. You know, lay whatever's in here out this way, and it does it. That would be my, I think, yeah, maybe this is like Jen Simmons' whole thing, but it's, I think like CSS Grid is the cure to layout problems and inflexibility. I don't think Flexbox necessarily is, so. But if you want to embrace the flex, I do workshops at your company about but it's really just you just, it's a mindset. I mean, they may not want to do it yet, so
Good luck, Mr. Steven. It is tricky. You might want to have a little workshop, you know, that you run at your company where you give them a very interesting layout that anybody can look at and be like, that is cool. And then build it with a kind of a grid mentality that does interesting things. That doesn't need the small, medium, and large breakpoint, but does other kind of interesting things. I think you could do it with one well-placed shot.
I would wager right now removing Bootstrap grid in favor of CSS grid. And again, no judgment on Bootstrap. Great tool for a long time. But I would estimate it's a 10% code reduction.
I never think about grid with it. I think of it's these free components that you get with it. Like, it's funny that people reach for it for the grid. I feel like it's a minor add-on to Bootstrap. And really what you get is all these warnings and alerts and dialogues and drop-downs and buttons.
Nodal. So, well.
Okay.
Hey, we got a hard stop edition of the Shop Talk Show, so we're going to have to wrap it up. Thank you, everybody, for writing in. We love your questions. Please keep sending more. Thank you for downloading this in your podcatcher's choice. Be sure to star heart favorite it up. That's how people find out about the show. If you want to, follow us on Twitter at Shop Talk Show for tens of tweets a month. And if you hate your job, head over to shoptalkshow.com/jobs and get a brand new one, because people want to hire people like you. And Chris, you got anything else you'd like to say?
Oh, just that, shoptalkshow.com.